The pathogenic sow. Microbes, infections, and the antibiotic revolution. Like hermits, microbes need only be concerned with feeding themselves. Neither coordination nor cooperation with others is necessary, though some microbes occasionally join forces. In contrast, cells in a multicellular organism, from the 4 cells in some algae to the 37 trillion in a human, give up their independence to stick together tenaciously. They take on specialized functions, and they curtail their own reproduction for the greater good, growing only as much as they need to fulfill their functions. When they rebel, cancer can break out. Elizabeth Panisi, Science, 2018. Rudolf Virchow was not the only scientist to arrive at an understanding of cells by contemplating pathology in the 1850s. The animalcules that Antony van Leeuwenhoek had visualized tumbling under his microscope almost 2 centuries earlier were likely autonomous single-celled living beings, microbes. And although the vast majority of such microbes are harmless, some have the capacity to invade human tissues and initiate inflammation, putrefaction, and deadly diseases. It was germ theory that microbes are independent, living cells capable, in some cases, of causing human illnesses that would first bring the cell, in this case the microbial cell, into intimate contact with pathology and medicine. The link between microbial cells and human disease emerged from the answer to a question that had preoccupied scientists and philosophers for centuries. What is the cause of rot? Rot wasn't just a scientific problem, but also a theological one. In some Christian doctrines, the bodies of saints and kings were supposedly spared putrefaction, especially as they awaited the intermediate state between death, resurrection, and ascension to heaven. Yet when the decomposition rates of saints and sinners seemed no different, there was a theological reckoning to be had. Whatever caused putrefaction apparently wasn't behaving according to the laws of God. It was hard, after all, to reconcile a divine corpse ascending to the heavens with decomposing pieces of it falling off like corporeal jetsam. In 1668, Francesco Redi published a controversial article titled Experiments on the Generation of Insects. Redi concluded that maggots, one of the first signs of putrefying material, could arise only from eggs laid by flies, not out of thin air, again challenging the vitalist doctrine of spontaneous generation. When Redi covered a piece of veal or fish with a thin muslin veil, allowing in air but not flies, the flesh remained free of maggots, while the same flesh, exposed to air and flies, grew abundant maggots. Earlier theories of miasma dictated that the decomposition of flesh arose from within, or from miasma, floating in the air. Redi argued that this decomposition arose when living cells, maggot eggs, landed on flesh from the air. Omni vivum ex vivo, Redi wrote, all life comes from life. The founder of experimental biology, as he is known, had, in short, enunciated the precursor to Virchow's much bolder statement. Life came from life, he proposed, just a step away from the idea that cells came from cells. In Paris in 1859, Louis Pasteur took Redi's experiments further. He placed boiled meat broth in a swan neck bottle, a round flask with a vertical neck bent into an S shape like a swan's neck. When Pasteur left the swan neck bottle open to the air, the broth remained sterile. Microbes in the air could not easily travel through the curve in the neck. But when he tipped the flask to expose the broth to the air, or cracked the swan neck, the broth grew out a turbid culture of microbes. Bacterial cells, Pasteur concluded, are carried in air and dust. Putrefaction, or rotting, was not caused by the inner decomposition of living creatures, or some visceral form of interior sin. Rather, decomposition only happened when these bacterial cells landed on the broth. Decomposition and disease might have seemed superficially very different, but Pasteur made a crucial link between them. He studied infections in silkworms, the decomposition of wine, and the transmission of anthrax in animals. In all these cases, he determined that infections were caused not by the consequence of floating particles of miasma or divine malefactions, but by invasions by microbes, single-celled organisms that entered other organisms and caused pathological changes and tissue degeneration. In Wolstein, Germany, Robert Koch, a young, low-ranking but medically trained officer working in a makeshift lab, made the most radical advances to Pasteur's theory. In early 1876, he'd learned to isolate anthrax bacteria from infected cows and sheep and visualize them under a microscope. They were quivering, transparent, rod-shaped microbes, and though fragile-looking, potentially lethal. The bacteria could also form round, dormant spores highly resistant to desiccation or heat. Add water or put them in a susceptible host, and the spores would spring back from dormancy to deadly life, generating the rod-shaped anthrax bacilli, multiplying rapidly and unleashing the disease. Koch took a droplet of blood from an anthrax-infected cow, made a tiny slit in the tail of a mouse with a sterile wooden sliver, and waited. It remains an incredible, if inexplicable, lapse in the history of biology that, until 1876, no other scientist had experimented with transferring disease from one organism to the next in a systematic, scientific manner. You can see an illustration of Koch's work in the attached PDF. Anthrax bacteria secrete a poisonous toxin that kills cells. The mouse developed anthrax lesions. Its spleen was dark and swollen with dead cells, and its lungs pitted with similar black lesions. When Koch examined the spleen under a microscope, he found the same quivering, rod-shaped bacteria teeming inside it, surrounded by millions of dead mouse cells. He then repeated the experiment, inoculating a mouse, harvesting the spleen, and transferring a droplet to yet another mouse, a full 20 times. Each time, the recipient mouse developed anthrax. Koch's final experiment was his most ingenious. He created a sterile glass chamber and hung a droplet of liquid extracted from a dead ox's eye inside it. He injected a piece of spleen from an anthrax-infected mouse into the droplet. The same rod-shaped bacteria grew thickly in the fluid, making the clear droplet dusky with microbial cells. The march of Koch's experiments was steady and systematic, almost drill-like in its precision. Louis Pasteur had assumed causality by association. The rotting of wine was associated with an overgrowth of bacteria. The putrefaction of broth was linked to its contact with microorganisms. Koch, in contrast, desired a more formal architecture of causality. First, he had isolated a microorganism from a diseased animal. Next, he demonstrated that introducing the pathogen into healthy animals caused the same disease. Then he'd re-isolated the microbe from inoculated animals, grown the organism again in pure form in a culture, and shown that it could recreate the disease. How could anyone puncture the logic? In view of this fact, he wrote in his notes, all doubts as to whether the Bacillus anthracis is really the cause and contagium of anthrax just fall silent. In 1884, 8 years after he had concluded his anthrax experiments, Koch used his observations and experiments to postulate four tenets of a theory of causality for a microbial disease. To claim that a microbe causes a particular illness, in the way that, say, Streptococcus causes pneumonia or Bacillus anthracis causes anthrax, he proposed the following. 1. The organism microbial cell must be found in a diseased individual, not in a healthy individual. 2. The microbial cell must be isolated and cultured from the diseased individual. 3. The inoculation of a healthy individual with the cultured microbe must recapitulate the essential features of the disease. And 4. The microbe must be re-isolated from the inoculated individual and match the original microorganism. Koch's postulates of disease causality, while applicable to most infectious diseases, do not take host factors into account and are not easily applied to non-infectious diseases. Smoking, for instance, causes lung cancer, but not all cigarette smokers get lung cancer. You cannot isolate cigarette smoke from a cancer patient and transmit the disease to a second patient, although secondary smoking can certainly cause lung cancer. HIV indubitably causes AIDS, but not every individual exposed to HIV gets infected by the virus and develops AIDS, as host genetics affect the virus's capacity to enter cells. You cannot isolate a microbe or cause from patients with the neurodegenerative disease multiple sclerosis, MS, or transfer the disease to another human. Over time, epidemiologists would create a broader criteria to determine causality for non-infectious diseases. Koch's experiments and his tenets resonated deeply through biology and medicine, deeply influencing Pasteur's thinking as well. And yet, despite their intellectual proximity, or perhaps because of it, Koch and Pasteur developed a seething rivalry over the next decades. Of course, the Franco-Prussian War of the 1870s did not particularly encourage scientific camaraderie between the French and Germans either. Pasteur's papers on anthrax, published nearly contemporaneously with Koch's, used the French term bacteridia with almost vindictive pleasure, referring to Koch's terminology in an obscure footnote, Bacillus anthracis of the Germans, and Koch traded scientific insult for mockery. Up to now, Pasteur's work on anthrax has led to nothing, he wrote in a French journal in 1882. The French scientist Casimir Devain had also observed rod-shaped microorganisms in anthrax specimens and called them bacteridia. Pasteur's use of the term was scientific homage to his French colleague and a snub to the Germans. Boiled down to its essence, their scientific quarrel was rather minor. Pasteur insisted that by repeated culture in the lab, bacterial cells could be weakened in their ability to cause disease, or in the jargon of biology, attenuated. Pasteur intended to use attenuated anthrax as a vaccine. The weakened bacteria would strengthen immunity but not cause disease. According to Koch, however, attenuation was nonsense, as microbes were constant in their pathogenicity. In time, both men would be proved correct. Some microbes can be attenuated, while others are difficult to temper. But taken together, Pasteur's and Koch's work pointed to a new direction in pathology. Autonomous, living microbial cells they had demonstrated caused both putrefaction and disease, at least in animal models and in cultures. But what was the association between putrefaction caused by microbial cells and human disease? The first hint of a potential link came from a Hungarian obstetrician, Ignaz Semmelweis, who worked as an assistant in a Viennese maternity hospital in the late 1840s. The clinic was divided into two wards, the first clinic and the second clinic. Childbirth in the 19th century was almost as much life-threatening as it was life-giving. Infections, puerperal fever, or more colloquially, childbed fever, caused postpartum death rates that ranged from 5% to 10% for mothers. Semmelweis noted a peculiar pattern. Compared with the second clinic, the first clinic had a significantly higher rate of maternal mortality from childbed fever. News of this discrepancy, spread via gossip and rumor throughout Vienna, was an open secret. Pregnant women would beg, cajole, or manipulate their way to be admitted to the second clinic. Some women wisely even opted for so-called street births outside the clinics, reasoning that the first clinic was a far more dangerous place to have a baby than the street. What protected those who delivered outside the clinic from these destructive unknown endemic influences? Semmelweis mused. It was a rare opportunity to perform a natural experiment. Two women with the same condition entered through two doors of the same hospital. One emerged with a healthy newborn. The other was dispatched to the morgue. Why? Like a detective eliminating potential culprits, Semmelweis made a mental list of causes, crossing them off one by one. It wasn't overcrowding, or the women's ages, or the lack of ventilation, or the length of their labor, or how close the beds were to one another. In 1847, Semmelweis's colleague, Dr. Jacob Kolechka, cut himself with a scalpel while performing an autopsy. He was soon febrile and septic. Semmelweis could hardly help but notice that Kolechka's symptoms mirrored those of the women with childbed fever. Here, then, was a potential answer. The first clinic was run by surgeons and medical students who shuttled casually between the pathology department and the maternity ward. from performing cadaver dissections and autopsies straight to delivering babies. In contrast, the second clinic was run by midwives who had no contact with cadavers and never performed autopsies. Some of us wondered if the students and surgeons who routinely examined women without gloves were transferring some material substance, cadaverous material, he called it, from the decomposing cadavers into a pregnant woman's body. He insisted that the students and the surgeons wash their hands with chlorine and water before entering the maternity wards. Some of us kept careful records of the deaths in the two clinics. The impact was astonishing, with the mortality rate in the first clinic declining by 90%. In April 1847, the mortality rate had been nearly 20%. One in five women died of childbed fever. By August, after rigorous hand-washing had been instituted, the mortality among the new mothers had declined to 2%. As stunning as the results were, some of us had no explanation that he could visualize. Was it blood? A fluid? A particle? Senior surgeons in Vienna didn't believe in germ theory and had no interest in a junior assistant's insistence that they wash their hands between the clinics. Some of us was harassed and ridiculed, passed over for promotion, and eventually dismissed from the hospital. The idea that childbed fever was in fact a doctor's plague, an iatrogenic physician-induced disease, could hardly sit well with the professors of Vienna. He wrote increasingly frustrated and accusatory letters to obstetricians and surgeons all over Europe, all of whom dismissed Semmelweis as a crank. He eventually packed off to the backwaters of Budapest, only to suffer a mental breakdown. He was admitted to an asylum, where the guards beat him, leaving him with broken bones and a gangrenous foot. Ignaz Semmelweis died in 1865, most likely of sepsis caused by the injuries, consumed possibly by germs, the very material substance that he had tried to identify as a cause of infections. In the 1850s, not long after Semmelweis had been dismissed to Budapest, an English physician named John Snow was tracking the course of a raging cholera epidemic in the Soho area of London. Snow not only viewed diseases in terms of symptoms and treatments, but also regarded geography and transmission as contributing factors. He suspected instinctively that the epidemic was moving in particular patterns throughout particular districts and landscapes, which might provide a clue to its cause. Snow enlisted local residents to pinpoint the time and location of each case. Then he began to track the infection backward in time and space, as if watching a film in reverse, finding origins, sources, and causes. The source, Snow concluded, was not invisible miasma floating in the air, but rather water from a specific pump on Broad Street, from which the epidemic seemed to spread, or rather flow outward like the ripples from a stone tossed into a pond. When Snow later drew a map of the epidemic, marking every case of death with a bar, the bars surrounded that pump. A later map, drawn in the 1960s with dots marking the cases, is now more familiar to most epidemiologists. I found that nearly all the deaths had taken place within a short distance of the Broad Street pump, he wrote. There were only 10 deaths in houses situated decidedly nearer to another street pump. In 5 of these cases, the families of the deceased persons informed me that they always sent to the pump in Broad Street, as they preferred the water to that of the pumps which were nearer. In 3 other cases, the deceased were children who went to school near the pump in Broad Street. Snow's map can be seen in the attached PDF. But what substance was being carried by that contaminated source? By 1855, Snow had begun to examine the water under the microscope. He was convinced that it was something capable of reproduction, some particle with a structure and function capable of infecting and reinfecting humans. In his book On the Mode of Communication of Cholera, he wrote, "For the morbid matter of cholera having the property of reproducing its own kind must necessarily have some sort of structure, most likely that of a cell." It was a piercing insight, especially in its use of the word cell. Snow had, in essence, partially united 3 disparate theories and fields of medicine. The first, epidemiology, tried to explain the patterns of human disease in aggregate. As a discipline, epidemiology hovered above people, hence epi, above, the demos, people. It attempted to understand human diseases in terms of their transmission across populations, their rise and fall in incidence and prevalence, and their presence or absence in particular geographic or physical distributions, the distance, say, from the Broad Street pump. Ultimately, it was a discipline designed to assess risk. But Snow had also edged a theory of epidemiology toward a theory of pathology, from inferred risk to a material substance. Something, a cell no less, in that water was the cause of the infection. The geography or the map of illness was just a clue to its root cause. It was the sign of a physical substance moving through time and space, precipitating disease. Germ theory, the second field, still in its infancy, advanced the notion that infectious diseases were caused by microscopic organisms that invaded the body and disrupted its physiology. The third was the most audacious of all, cell theory, which held that the invisible microbe causing the disease was, in fact, an independent living organism, a cell that had contaminated the water. Snow had not seen the cholera bacillus under his microscope, but he had instinctively grasped that the causal elements had to be capable of reproducing in the body, re-entering the sewage, and restarting an infectious cycle. The infectious units had to be living entities capable of copying themselves. It occurs to me, as I write this, how much this framework, germs, cells, risk, still scaffolds the diagnostic art in medicine. Each time I see a patient, I realize I am probing the cause of his or her disease through three elemental questions. Is it an exogenous agent, such as a bacterium or virus? Is there an endogenous disturbance of cellular physiology? Is it the consequence of a particular risk, be it exposure to some pathogen, a family history, or an environmental toxin? Years ago, as a young oncologist, I met a previously healthy professor who was suddenly stricken with a relapsing fatigue that was so intense that there were days that he could not lift his limbs to climb out of bed. Over multiple visits to multiple specialists, he had been diagnosed with every conceivable illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, lupus, depression, a psychosomatic syndrome, and occult cancer. The garbled list went on and on. Every test had come back negative except for a blood test diagnosing him with chronic anemia, but a low red cell count is a symptom of disease, not a cause. Meanwhile, the weakness advanced relentlessly. A strange rash broke out on his back, another symptom without a cause. A few days later, the man was back in the clinic with no diagnosis. An X-ray revealed a filmy veil of fluid accumulated in the two-layer pleural sac that surrounds the lungs. I was now sure about the diagnosis. It was cancer, of course, that had been hiding all the while. I inserted a syringe between two ribs, withdrew a small amount of fluid, and sent it to the pathology lab. I was convinced that cancer cells would be found in the fluid, and we would clinch the case. Yet, before sending the patient for further scans and biopsies, I had niggling doubts. My instincts rose against the certitude of my own diagnosis, and so I sent him to the best internist I knew, an odd, otherworldly man who seemed at times almost like an anachronistic physician from another century. "Don't forget to smell the patient," this Proust among doctors had advised me once, then went on to list the number of illnesses that could be diagnosed by smell alone. I stood in his office listening and learning, flummoxed. A day later, the internist called me. Had I asked the patient about risks? I mumbled a vague yes, but realized shamefacedly that I had focused my assessment entirely on cancer. Did I know that my patient had spent the first 3 years of his life in India, the internist asked, or that he had traveled there several times since then? It hadn't occurred to me to ask. The man told me that he had lived in Belmont, Massachusetts since childhood, but I didn't probe further and ask him where he'd been born or when he had moved to the States. "And have you sent the lung fluid to the bacteriology lab?" wise Dr. Proust asked. By now my face was flushed. "Why?" "Because it's reactivated tuberculosis, of course." Thankfully, the lab had reserved half the fluid that I had sent. In 3 weeks, it grew out Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the causal agent of TB. The man was treated with appropriate antibiotics and recovered slowly. In a few months, all his symptoms had vanished. The whole episode was a lesson in humility. To this day, when I see a patient with an undiagnosable disease, I mumble quietly under my breath, recalling John Snow and my internist friend who liked to sniff patients. Germs, cells, risk. The medical application of germ theory was transformative. In Glasgow, Scotland, in 1864, just a few years after Louis Pasteur had completed his experiments on putrefaction, and more than a decade before Robert Koch would prove conclusively that microbes caused disease in animal models, a young surgeon named Joseph Lister chanced upon Pasteur's papers, Recherche sur la putrefaction. In an inspired leap, he made a connection between the putrefaction that Pasteur had witnessed in his swan neck flask and the surgical infections that he saw in his wards. Even in ancient India and Egypt, physicians cleaned their instruments by boiling them. Yet in Lister's time, surgeons paid little attention to the possibility of contamination by microbes. Surgery was an unfathomably unsanitary practice, as if designed intentionally to defy any historical knowledge of hygiene. For example, a pus-covered surgical probe removed from one patient's wound would then be inserted, unsterilized, into another person's body. In fact, surgeons used the phrase laudable pus because they thought that the presence of pus was part of the healing process. If a scalpel fell on a blood and pus-smeared operating room floor, the surgeon would simply wipe it clean on his equally contaminated apron and sanguinely proceed to use the same tool on his next patient. Lister decided to boil his tools in a solution that would kill the germs that he was convinced were causing the infection. But what solution? Carbolic acid, he knew, was used to remove the rancid stench from sewage and wastewater. If so, it was likely killing germs that created the miasmas surrounding sewage, he thought. And so, taking one inspired leap after another, he began boiling his surgical tools in carbolic acid. The rate of post-surgical infections plummeted. Wounds healed rapidly, and septic shock, the dreaded bane of every surgical procedure, was suddenly diminished in patients. At first, surgeons resisted Lister's theory, but the data became more and more incontrovertible. Like some of us, Lister had turned germ theory into medical practice. In a little less than a century, from the 1860s to the 1950s, sterility, hygiene, and antisepsis, the only established methods to prevent infections, would be vastly augmented by the invention of antibiotic drugs that killed microbial cells. In 1910, the first among these, an arsenic derivative known as arsphenamine, was discovered by Drs. Paul Ehrlich and Sahachiro Hata, who found it could kill syphilis-causing microbes. Soon, there was a seemingly limitless bounty of antibiotics, among them penicillin, an antibacterial chemical secreted by a fungus that was discovered in molding plates by Alexander Fleming in 1928, and the anti-TB drug streptomycin, isolated from bacteria and clods of dirt by Albert Schatz and Selman Waksman in 1943. Antibiotics, medicines that change the face of medicine, generally work because they attack something that distinguishes a microbial cell from the host cell. Penicillin kills the bacterial enzymes that synthesize the cell wall, resulting in bacteria with holes in their walls. Human cells don't possess these particular kinds of cell walls, thereby making penicillin a magic bullet against bacterial species that rely on the integrity of their cell walls. Every potent antibiotic, doxycycline, rifampin, levofloxacin, recognizes some molecular component of human cells that is different from a bacterial cell. In this sense, every antibiotic is a cellular medicine, a drug that relies on the distinctions between a microbial cell and a human cell. The more we learn about cell biology, the subtler distinctions we uncover, and the more potent antimicrobials we can learn to create. Before we leave antibiotics and the microbial world, let's dwell for a moment on distinctions. Every cell on Earth, which is to say every unit of every living being, belongs to one of three entirely distinctive domains, or branches, of living organisms. The first branch comprises bacteria, single-celled organisms that are surrounded by a cell membrane, lack particular cellular structures found in animal and plant cells, and possess other structures that are unique to them. It is precisely these differences that are the basis for the specificity of the antibacterial drugs previously mentioned. Bacteria are disturbingly, ferociously, uncannily successful. They dominate the cellular world. We think of them as pathogens, Bartonella, Pneumococcus, Salmonella, because a few of them cause disease. But our skin, our guts, and our mouths are teeming with several billion bacteria that cause no disease whatsoever. Science writer Ed Yong's seminal book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life, provides a panoramic view of our intimate and generally symbiotic pact with bacteria. In fact, bacteria are either harmless or actually helpful. In the gut, they aid digestion. On the skin, some researchers suspect they inhibit colonization by much more harmful microbes. An infectious disease specialist once told me that humans were just nice-looking luggage to carry bacteria around the world. He might have been right. The abundance and resilience of bacteria stagger the mind. Some live in oceanic thermal vents where the water reaches near boiling temperature. They could easily thrive inside a steaming kettle. Some prosper within stomach acid. Yet others live with seemingly equal ease in the coldest places on Earth, where the land freezes into packed, impenetrable tundra for 10 months of the year. They are autonomous, mobile, communicative, and reproductive. They have powerful mechanisms of homeostasis that maintain their internal milieu. They are perfectly self-sufficient hermits, but can also cooperate to share resources. We, you and me, inhabit a second branch or domain called eukaryotes. The word eukaryote is a technicality. It refers to the idea that our cells, and the cells of animals, fungi, and plants, contain a special structure called a nucleus, carion or kernel in Greek. This nucleus, as we will soon learn, is a storage site for chromosomes. Bacteria lack nuclei and are called prokaryotes, that is, before nuclei. Compared with bacteria, we are fragile, feeble, finicky beings capable of inhabiting vastly more limited environments and restricted ecological niches. And now the third branch, archaea. It may be the singularly most startling fact in the history of taxonomy that this full branch of living beings remained undiscovered until about 50 years ago. In the mid-1970s, Carl Woese, a professor of biology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, used comparative genetics, the comparison of genes across various organisms, to deduce that we had misclassified not just some arcane microbe, but rather an entire domain of life. For decades, Woese fought a spirited but lonely, bitter war that left him ragged at the edges. Taxonomy wasn't just missing the point, he insisted. It was missing a whole living domain. Archaea, Woese argued, were not almost like bacteria or almost like eukaryotes. Almost like is the taxonomist's version of a parent saying to a child, "Go away, you're bothering me." Many prominent biologists ridiculed or simply ignored Woese's work. In 1998, Ernst Mayr, the biologist, wrote an essay on Woese drenched with teacherly condescension. Quote, "Evolution is an affair of phenotypes, not genes," close quote. Getting the story exactly wrong, it wasn't evolution that Woese was contesting, it was taxonomy, which is precisely the question of genes. A bat and a bird may have nearly the same physical characteristics or phenotypes. It's the difference in their genes that gives away the secret. They belong to different taxa. The journal Science described Woese as a scarred revolutionary. But decades later, we have largely accepted, validated, and vindicated his theory so that archaea are now classified as a distinct third domain of living creatures. Superficially, archaea look like bacteria for the most part. They are tiny and lack some of the structures associated with animal and plant cells, but they are indisputably different from bacteria or from plant, animal, and fungal cells. In fact, we still know relatively little about them. As Nick Lane, the evolutionary biologist at University College London, puts it in his book, The Vital Question, Energy, Evolution, and the Origins of Complex Life, they're the Cheshire cats of the living kingdom, absolutely essential to the full story, yet asserting their presence only by their absence. In other words, by the fact that they lack the defining features of the other two domains, partly because we've ignored studying them until recently. This division of life into its principal domains returns us to yet another essential distinction in the trajectory of our story of cells. There are, in fact, two intersecting stories here. The first is the history of cell biology. We have journeyed through vast territory in this first story, from Leeuwenhoek to Hooke, visualizing cells in the late 1600s, to the discovery of tissues and organs 2 centuries later, and from the discovery of bacteria as a cause of putrefaction and disease by Pasteur and Koch to Ehrlich's synthesis of the first antibiotics in 1910. We've moved from the origins of cellular physiology, Raspail's luminously prescient every cell is a kind of laboratory, to the young Virchow's brazen proposition that the cell is the locus of both normal physiology and pathology. But that is the history of cell biology, not the history of the cell. The cell's history dwarfs that of cell biology by millennia. The first cells, the simplest, most primitive of our ancestors, arose on Earth some 3.5 to 4 billion years ago, about 700 million years after the birth of the Earth. That is a remarkably short period, if you think about it. Only about a fifth of the history of the Earth had passed before living beings were already reproducing on it. How did that first cell arise? What did it look like? Evolutionary biologists have grappled with these questions for decades. The simplest cell, call it a protocell, had to possess a genetic information system that could reproduce itself. The cell's original replication system was almost certainly made of a strand-like molecule called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. Indeed, in lab experiments, simple chemicals placed in conditions that resemble the atmospheric conditions on primitive Earth and trapped within layers of clay can give rise to precursors of RNA and even strands of RNA molecules. But the transition from an RNA strand to a self-replicating RNA molecule is no small evolutionary feat. Most likely, two such molecules were needed, one to act as the template, i.e. the information carrier, and the other to make a copy of the template, i.e. a duplicator. When these two RNA molecules, template and duplicator, met each other, it was perhaps the most important and explosive evolutionary love affair in the history of our living planet. But the lovers had to avoid separation. If the two strands of RNA were to float away from each other, there would be no duplication and, by extension, no cellular life. And so some sort of structure, a spherical membrane, was likely needed to confine these components. These three components, a membrane, an RNA information carrier, and a duplicator, might have defined the first cell. If a self-replicating RNA system were bound by a spherical membrane, it would make more RNA copies within the confines of the sphere and grow in size by enlarging the membrane. At some point, biologists believe the membrane-bound spheroid would split into two, each carrying the RNA duplicating system. In lab experiments, Jack Szostak and his colleagues have shown that simple spheroidal structures bound by membranes formed by fat molecules can absorb more fat molecules, grow, and eventually split into two. And from that point on, the protocell would launch its long evolutionary march toward the progenitor of the modern cell. Evolution would select more and more complex features of the cell, eventually replacing RNA with DNA as the information carrier. Bacteria evolved out of that simple progenitor about 3 billion years ago, and they continue to evolve today. Archaea are probably at least as old as bacteria, arising around the same time, although the precise date is still noisily and vigorously debated, and also continue to exist and to evolve to this day. This audiobook will not cover this entirely third group of cellular beings, archaea, except for a brief mention. Some biologists argue that features of the modern cell may be explained by some kind of cooperative assembly between bacteria and archaea, but there's debate about the extent to which the evolution of archaea or some common ancestor contributes to the evolution of nucleus-bearing cells, that is to say, our modern cells. These arguments are essential to evolutionary biologists exploring the early history of life, but lie outside the scope of this audiobook. But what about non-bacterial, non-archaeal cells? In other words, our cells. About 2 billion years ago, once again, the exact date is a matter of debate, evolution took a strange and inexplicable turn. That is, when a cell that is the common ancestor of human cells, plant cells, fungi cells, and amoebal cells appeared on Earth. This ancestor, as Lane puts it, was recognizably a modern cell with an exquisite internal structure and unprecedented molecular dynamism, all driven by sophisticated nanomachines encoded by thousands of new genes that are largely unknown in bacteria. New evidence suggests that this modern eukaryotic cell arose within archaea. In other words, life has only two principal domains, bacteria and archaea, and eukaryotes, our cells, represent a relatively recent sub-branch of archaea. We are, perhaps, life come lately, the sawdust left over from the carvings of the two main domains of life. In the parts and chapters that follow, we are about to meet this modern cell. We will encounter its elaborate internal anatomy. We'll discover its unprecedented molecular dynamism that enables reproduction and development. We will understand how organized systems of cells, multicellular systems with specialized forms and functions, enable the formation and function of organs and organ systems, maintain the constancy of the body, repair broken ankles, and combat decay. And we will contemplate a future where we use this knowledge to develop medicines that attempt to build functional parts of new humans to ameliorate or cure diseases. But there is one question that we will not, and perhaps cannot, answer. The origin of the modern cell is an evolutionary mystery. It seems to have left only the scarcest of fingerprints of its ancestry or lineage, with no trace of a second or third cousin, no close enough peers that are still living, no intermediary forms. Lane calls it an unexplained void, the black hole at the heart of biology. We will soon move to the anatomy, function, development, and specialization of this modern eukaryotic cell. But it is this second story, of the origin of ourselves, that neither this audiobook nor evolutionary science can yet fully convey. Part 2. The One and the Many. The words organism and organized share a common root. Both come from the Greek organon, later the Latin organum, an instrument or tool or even a method of logic designed to achieve something. If the cell is the basic unit of life, the living tool that forms the organism, then what is it designed to do? Well, first, it has evolved to be autonomous, to survive as an independent living unit. This autonomy depends, in turn, on organization, on the cell's interior anatomy. A cell is not a blob of chemicals. It has distinct structures or subunits within it that allow it to function independently. The subunits are designed to supply energy, discard waste, store nutrients, sequester toxic products, and maintain the internal milieu of a cell. Second, a cell is designed to reproduce so that one cell can produce all the other cells that populate the organism's body. And finally, for multicellular organisms, the cell, or at least the first cell, is designed to differentiate and develop into other specialized cells so that various parts of the body, tissues, organs, organ systems, can be formed. These, then, are among the first and most fundamental properties of the cell: autonomy, reproduction, and development. In single-celled organisms, one might think of development as the maturation of the organism. The maturation of single-celled microbial organisms is now well established. In multicellular organisms, development is more complex. It is a combination of the multiplication of cells, their maturation, their movement to distinct locations, their association with other cells, and their formations of specialized structures with specialized functions to form organs and tissues. For centuries, we regarded these fundamental features as impregnable. The interior anatomy of the cell and its internal homeostasis were, well, interior and internal, black boxes. Reproduction and development occurred within the womb, another black box. But as we deepen our understanding of the cell, we find ourselves able to pry open these black boxes and alter the fundamental properties of living units. Can we repair a cell's subunit that happens to be defective in function? And if so, to what extent? Can we build a cell with a different kind of interior milieu, different substructures, and therefore different properties? And if we enable human reproduction outside the womb, as we have already, will such an artificially created embryo be open to genetic manipulation? What then are the permissible limits and perils of tampering with the first fundamental properties of life?